Hi there and welcome. This is Conscious Living. I'm Wendy Garrett on Empower Radio. Thanks for tuning in. Hope you're having a great day wherever you are and all sorts of fun things are happening in your life and you're keeping it light. Well, for the most part. Yeah, I have an agenda. It's because that nightlight thing, the lights just go with it. My guest today is a really fascinating person because he's done all sorts of secret things. Fortunately, we can talk about the stuff that isn't secret, the remote viewing secrets. Joe McMonagle, I've got the handbook. But there's so much more to him than just remote viewing. So we just want to give it an introduction and tell Joe thank you for sharing his information because it's really helpful to understand the differences between some of these abilities and what remote viewing actually is from somebody who's used it on a professional level and a military actually level that might make it a little more credible. Joe, thank you for talking with me.
Oh, you're very welcome, Wendy. I'm glad to be on your show.
There are so many people who think you are pretty much a god when it comes to this information. Is that a little intimidating with that label?
I wish they wouldn't use it. there are plenty of people in the world that are just as good at this as I am, and there's a multitude of them in different countries and different places, and they use it for all kinds of different things. So it's not that unusual, I don't think, anyway.
All right. And when you got started doing this, was it before the military thing? I mean, how did this factor into your life?
Well, I've been psychic my whole life. And so when I say that, I say it tongue in cheek because we know from the science, the investigations that we've done in labs at both at SRI, Science Applications International Corporation, as well as the Cognitive Sciences Lab where I work now, that all human beings who walk the planet are psychic to one degree or another. It's probably derived or a derivative of our survival capability. So it's a very old talent. Everybody has it. The difficulty is that not everyone has it to the same degree. It's very much like a sport or something that requires talent. Tennis or golf or bowling or almost anything like that, where you only find out how good you are or the level at which you can operate by in becoming involved in that sport and testing yourself and your skill levels.
Well, you talk about viewing it much like a martial art where you're constantly working on that ability.
Yeah. The reason I say martial art is because it requires a tremendous amount of mental discipline because you everything you do in remote viewing is different from just being psychic in that you have to deal with everything from internalized, the generation of internalized noise to beating off the ego and defending yourself against the ego part of your mind, which tries to control and run everything. So it's a difficult process. In the end, it turns out to be very difficult.
Well, and there would be an emotional thing, too, where some things you're going to run into may trigger an unconscious and reflexive response, and you have to get around that.
Oh, yeah. None of it's really bad. I mean, it's not difficult to deal with most of these issues. It's just that there's so many of them, and they're going on all the time. They just never go away. So you're never, for instance, you're never quite capable of defeating your personal ego. So it becomes a constant battle that goes on forever in the attempts to do remote viewing. But it's an issue. Those are issues that you have to address if you expect to become better at it, or you expect to improve your own talent. Level of talent.
What is the best use for remote viewing?
Oh, goodness. I personally think the best use for remote viewing is finding missing children. In the things that I've done in my life, I would have to say that the one thing that stands above all the others is when you have a success in finding a very small child, say age 5 or age 4, who has disappeared in the woods or has gone out to play in the yard with their dogs, and the dogs come back, but the child doesn't. And you have an inability to know exactly where to look. Getting a hint from remote viewing and going out and exercising your search based on that hint and then finding the child alive or in good condition is nothing surpasses that in terms of feedback.
Well, I would say that pet animals, when you lose the cat, the dog, and they're not at the pound, but attached, and there's just no way, there's no substitute when you have that sense of loss.
That's exactly right. I mean, it really makes me feel very good anyway.
Yeah.
I enjoy those.
I get a lot of in this field when you're talking metaphysics and parapsychology and psychics and ghosts and all that. People want to somehow predict the future with remote viewing or predict what's on Mars or predict ETs and all this. And mm-hmm. there's no way to validate or verify some of that stuff.
Well, that's true. And for instance, I don't like participating in remote viewings of targets where there is no ground truth or you can't obtain ground truth eventually. I've done targets where I've waited for over a decade for the feedback because no one knew. But we were able to eventually arrive at some fact of ground truth that could be compared to the outcome. And that's nice when you get that kind of feedback.
What was? Can you name one of those types?
It involved a number of people at Stanford Research Institute Lab, the SRI International Lab was tasked us with describing some of the outer rim planets and the makeup of their atmospheres, what they look like, actually physically look like, many years before the arrival of the first Explorer satellites. If you remember, they launched four Explorer satellites, and we did the remote viewing many, many years prior to the actual arrival of those first satellites, and we were able to find that that the remote viewing, the descriptions of some of those planets and some of the peculiarities about them turned out to be correct. So that's the kind of predictive sort of thing.
And to me, some of that, you know, the shamans have had this kind of access and awareness for centuries, because that if you're talking Copernicus or you're talking some of the discoverers, explorers, archaeologists or astronomers from way back, they had to have had some of these abilities that they tapped into to be able to do some of the to bring back information in their own time that we would have considered magic.
Well, if you remember, I said at the beginning that it's probably, we don't know this to be true, by the way, but I suspect very strongly that it's part of our survival mechanism, our ability to survive, make appropriate decisions under stress. And you have to remember that back in the old days, there was no internet and there were no libraries that were accessible to people, you know, to the average person. And so when you found yourself under life threat, for instance, and had to make a very quick decision as to what action to take or what direction to go in, all of those decisions were usually made very instinctively because you didn't have a source of information. And in many cases, those decisions were made by the shaman or the leader of the tribal group that you belong to. And so if you had a really psychic shaman or someone with a powerful psychic ability leading the tribe, then in all probability your tribe would survive, where the ones with the poorer shaman wouldn't.
You're talking in the book about people who make good remote viewers, and you talk about the mental state and why it's important to be able to, I think, be flexible in your philosophy and your theology, because you're going to confront or be confronted by some things that will test your foundation. Can you explain or go into more of that?
Well, the way way we think things work and the way we usually find out they do work is sometimes very different. And one of the problems it's a problem that occurs in even within the world of science or engineering or almost any field you can pick. Many people get very wedded to their own personal ideas about certain things. If you become too wedded to your ideas, then you're no longer open to what the difference might be between what you believe to be true and what turns out to actually be true. And if you're unable to assimilate the new information and change your belief structure, then you wind up becoming detrimental to the new findings and the possibility of capitalizing on whatever the new findings might be. It sometimes takes a long time for science to change its opinion about things, simply because the people that sort of reinforce those opinions are not open to change based on new information that might have been gathered by some of their own peers.
In your experience with remote viewing, have you ever had anything that frightened you?
That's frightened me?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, something that either the encounter, the information, the level of content, or just a total paradigm shift from what you thought reality should be.
Well, not really. I can't remember working on anything that was that diverse from the norm. Certainly within the norm of our culture, anyway, there are a lot of things that that can be distressing or depressing, that kind of thing. We certainly have lots of things going on in the world right now that would depress us. So in a sense, I guess working on some of those, you could say you would become depressed over time working on a number of targets or issues that would be depressing. But that's no more a problem for a remote viewer than it would be for, say, a street cop or a detective or someone who actually is where their job requires them to know more about those kinds of things going on in the world. I imagine, for instance, that a prosecuting attorney gets pretty tired over time with taking the same kinds of people into court and ruining their lives by giving them or convicting them of some of the crimes that they do. You'd think that some people would learn, but some people don't. And so I can see where that would wear someone down as a prosecutor. Well, the same thing applies with a remote viewer. You deal with very similar issues in terms of surprises and similar issues with regard to emotional impact. I don't like seeing a family of five, for instance, murdered in their home any more than a policeman does. So, but in terms of actually frightening me in some way, no, I've got too much experience in the world, I think, and I've traveled too much and been exposed to too much to say that I'm frightened by any of it.
Are you doing any current work that that might be considered more along a military or maybe police line that you can talk about the types of applications that this might have for current, I guess, investigation or military purposes?
Well, one of the great issues in terms of police work is when you have someone who you have sufficient circumstantial evidence to show that they may have been involved in the murder of another individual, and but they've been successful in hiding the body, for instance. Remote viewing can be used to point the law enforcement individuals in a specific direction for maybe looking for the body assisting in finding the remains. But in terms of what I'm in fact working on a number of cases right now that are somewhat similar. But since I guarantee total anonymity to all of my clients, regardless of who they might be, I never discuss what I work on. In fact, it's been a problem in the past. I just don't talk about what I work on with my clients. The way I do, however, deal with some of those issues is I do a number of demonstrations. I've done probably more than 100 demonstrations live on camera in order to, to still be able to show how remote viewing works and that kind of thing.
That makes sense. Well, I was just thinking with the recent case with the man who was just apprehended for shooting the police, and he'd been on the run, and they said, well, we just got lucky. We happened to be there at the right time, had a hunch. And yeah. So those are the kind of cases I think where remote viewers would be very helpful.
Well, the key word there is we had a hunch on where to look. One of the interesting things is many people who perform extremely well and make a career out of law enforcement, it turns out, happen to be very, very psychic and very sensitive to the remote viewing kind of issues. So you might stop them and say, we think you're probably psychic because your closure rate on cases is much higher than the norm. And they'll look at you and say, you're crazy. I don't believe in that stuff. I operate from my gut, which is basically saying the same thing.
Kind of close. Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah. Well, it's more acceptable.
It doesn't challenge culture, and culture, therefore, doesn't feel a need to slap them down or ridicule them in any way.
Okay. So if somebody's trying to learn this and they're really focused on somehow validating their results. And we're talking again, Joe McMonagle, Remote Viewing Secrets is the handbook that I'm referring some of these questions from and about. But when people are wanting to help expand their abilities, what's a good way to start? You talk in the book about personalities that might be more adept at this. You also talk about environments and diet, that kind of thing, which it used to be that people thought, well, anybody could do it and it didn't make any difference what kind of person you are. But these things are really factors into the ability to be successful, I think, like you mentioned with somebody who's a police officer and able to come up with a good closure rate. Is there a personality type that this works better with, or some things that you can do to enhance your own sensitivity?
Yes, it turns out that there are quite a few things that you could pay attention to that would basically improve the probability of finding someone who might be a much more talented individual, let's say, than someone else. Remember I mentioned the difference in talent level, which is more individualistic thing. And some of those things are really easy to identify. For instance, we know that people who are generally considered to be world-class psychics or remote viewers usually come from backgrounds of significant child abuse when they were growing up. Now, understand, these are not fixed in stone. Many of these things may occur and many of them may not, but I'm speaking in gross generalities right now. Many remote viewers have significant artistic ability. In other words, they're able to express artistically what they're sensing, draw pictures, that sort of thing, about what it is they're sensing, which is more accurate in many cases than defining those things verbally. And then there's the fact that many are able to deal with some of the issues that would be emotionally invasive to some. There's just a multitude of things like that. I think the most significant item is probably the fact that you need to have a somewhat open mind and be open to the possibility that such a system can work. and that you can apply it and use it in many different ways.
In some of this, you also talk about the other things that can be used with dowsing and different types of supportive tools or supportive methods.
Yeah.
Can you go into that a little bit?
Yeah. When I was in the military side of the Army START, what was called or referred to as the Stargate Project, it operated under five or six different identities or names for a little bit less than 20 years. We gave psychic support or remote viewing support to almost every intelligence agency in America, to include CIA, DIA, DEA, that kind of thing. And in doing so, many of those efforts turned out to be significant value, but a lot of it, you know, doesn't work. A lot of it didn't work, and it was still something that was of value to some degree. When many of these agencies would get stuck on finding an answer, for instance, to a problem, they might work on that problem, that significant intelligence problem, for a long period of time, a year or a year and a half, and if they couldn't seem to crack the problem, it was sometimes passed to us, and we were able to solve the problem eventually, sometimes within a few hours and sometimes within a few days, which is significant. But we were never really 100% successful, although a lot of people make that claim. But all of our efforts were no different than any effort made by any intelligence analyst or operative might try to do to solve the same problem. So there's really no difference between using your psychic ability to try to address a problem. There's no difference in doing that than sitting at a desk and going through hundreds and thousands of sheets of paper or photos or something, looking for something that might click, that would give you some insight that might solve the problem.
Well, and you go to a great length to try and establish the correct protocols for doing remote viewing and what might be helpful and what might be lead you completely the wrong direction. Some of it's picking up on the information around you that people are unknowingly telegraphing.
Yeah, well, the significant thing between being psychic, just, you know, doing things in a psychic way, and doing remote viewing is the protocol. Most psychics operate without a protocol. It's a very spontaneous thing. They may talk to a detective or something and get lots of information about what the problem is and what the detectives are trying to solve in terms of the difficulties in you know, solving the problem. So they interact very closely and they talk a great deal about the problem they're working on. A remote viewer can't do that. There are two actual protocols that have been generated at Stanford Research Institute in the early to mid 70s for remote viewing, and these protocols are significantly similar. And one of the requirements in those protocols is that while attempting to produce psychic information, you cannot be in a room with anyone who knows anything at all about the problem. In other words, you have to be totally blind to what it is you're working on. Now, I know that sounds kind of bizarre, but the idea here is that you're taking someone who is predisposed to being psychic, and you're putting them in a room, and you're forcing them to be psychic. In other words, you're not giving them any hints. And there's a number of other reasons why you wouldn't want to give them hints. First, we know that anyone else in the room that might know something about the problem they're working on is communicating, even though they may not be communicating verbally. It's called a nonverbal communication. And we also know that probably more than 50% of communication is taking place between two or more individuals can take place in a nonverbal way. In other words, you don't have to talk to someone to tell them something.
Right.
There's all kinds of ways that that information can get passed, even though you're not maybe not speaking about it.
I want to come back and talk and pick up in that part, the being able to deliver information without intending to. We'll pick up. We're talking with remote viewer Joe McMonagall, okay? The book I have is Remote Viewing Secrets, a handbook, and there's all sorts of information on the web and the Monroe Institute. You can find out how to get classes and take more information from Joe. In the meantime, we're going to take a quick break and come back and talk about some things that we might be telegraphing that we have no clue we're doing, but we're good at it. That good.
Hey, Larry, mind if I sit down?
Nope.
This coffee tastes like coffee. So what's going on?
Not much.
What's new?
Not much.
Okay, but can you please put the newspaper down while you say not much?
What newspaper?
This newspaper. Oh, dude, what happened to your face? I see one, two,
ow,
three, four, five, six,
ow,
seven. Dude, what is
ow
this? 11 pieces of toilet paper stuck to your face?
I'm shaving in the dark to save energy. I'm helping the environment.
That's a dangerous way to help the environment.
Well, sometimes you have to sacrifice yourself for the greater good.
Dude, there's an easier and safer way to help the environment without sacrificing yourself. Go green, go public. Take public transportation. It's good for the environment and you won't have to live behind a newspaper.
Wow.
But for now, put the newspaper back up.
A message from the public transportation systems across the country. To learn more, visit publictransportation.org.
I'm home, and I love it. I'm home where I belong. I'm home, and I love it. I'm home where I belong.
It's always nice to come home. But these days, many Americans are at risk of foreclosure and losing their homes. Fortunately, help is available. Making Home Affordable is a free program from the U.S. government that has already helped over 1 million struggling homeowners, and we want to help you.
I'm home.
I'm home.
And I love it. I'm home.
I'm home.
Find out now what your options are. Go to makinghomeaffordable.gov or call 1-888-995-HOPE. The sooner you act, the better chance we can help you.
I'm home.
I'm home.
Where I be.
Brought to you by the U.S. Treasury, HUD, and the Ad Council.
Come to the forest. It's a place not so far away. A place where you don't have to mow the lawn or babysit.
I saw lizards and squirrels and bugs.
Ladybugs, caterpillars. It's really cool, actually.
A place where you don't have to make time for free time.
Lots and lots of kinds of species here.
Out here, you may even meet the mysterious creature known as the other you. The enchanted you.
It's magic what flowers do.
The adventurous you.
My favorite tree, yes, is that one.
The free-to-be-me you. Ask your parents to take you to this not-so-far-away place. Come to the forest, where the other you lives. But first, stop by discovertheforest.org, a public service announcement brought to you by the U.S. Forest Service and the Ad Council.
Hi there, we're back. I'm Wendy Garrett. This is Conscious Living on Empower Radio. My guest is Joe McMonagall. Remote Viewing Secrets. And we're going to talk a little bit more about some of the other things that go on around remote viewing in a minute. But first, I wanted to say there are so many reasons that a remote viewer would prefer to have zero access to the potential target or the information they're hoping to bring through. And one of those, this is a situation I had, a guy, one of the broadcasters I worked with maybe 10 or 15 years ago, he created this wonderful little game and you were supposed to know the answer. When you knew the answer, you would hit the button, whatever. And there were four of us. And I suddenly had all these answers. And I thought, oh my gosh, I don't know this. But the minute before I would hit the button, I would flash. The answer would flash. And I realized, and fortunately, I was never in a relationship with this person because that would be really frustrating. He would flash the information. So he was sending and I was picking up and I thought, oh, wow. But having that moment and knowing that this happens everywhere in some way, shape, or form with people throughout our lives, and we just don't acknowledge it, or we're not always aware that that's going on, that somebody is telegraphing or sending you information. And we have to be really aware of what we're thinking and how powerful those thoughts are in order to coordinate what you're being given and what you're hoping to receive. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it makes sense. There's even a multitude of other reasons why. For instance, in the problem of trying to help a detective, you can assume that the police department you're helping already knows a multitude of facts about the problem. And if they keep you blind to the entire problem and you don't know anything about it, then when you start to produce information and you pass this information to them, if they already know a lot of the facts, accurate facts about the issue, and you're passing them information which contains accurate facts that they already know, along with new information, then that provides them with a method of judging or adjudicating whether or not the information you're passing them is more accurate or less accurate.
Credibility. Words, yeah, it establishes a level of credibility.
You're establishing some credibility at the same time you're giving them new information. Another reason is that you may be, by giving them a hint, for instance, let's say the detective might say something to a psychic, like, we know the person left the scene of the crime. Can you describe the automobile they left in? Well, that might be an assumption. Maybe they didn't take an automobile from the crime. Maybe they got on a city bus, or they walked, or someone picked them up. We don't know the answer to those things. So by asking them or specifying information in a question, what you're doing is leading the individual to give you an inappropriate or inaccurate answer.
Absolutely. So, and sometimes that might be a bait just to see, okay, how good are you? And we know this isn't true. And if you take that bait and say, well, you know, I'm not sure what kind of car, you already are saying, I don't know.
Yes, exactly. And so there's just a multitude of reasons why you want to keep the person totally blind. But the main one is that you want to force the individual to have to rely on only psychic information, and not something that their ego mind or their mind is inventing or making up in some way to answer questions that they don't really know the answer to.
Is environment a factor? Because we're talking, my reason for this is ley lines, geometric places, or geomagnetic, I should say, energy. Are there some places on the planet where we are more, I guess, attuned to this type of energy? Does that help?
Actually, there are, but they're not determined by ley lines or other paranormal kinds of things. They're determined by real physics. For instance, we have a thing that's called it has to do with the angle of the Earth and its rotation, and how, where it faces, where the planet faces. We know that that if you are doing remote viewing at a very specific time and the location that you're standing in while you're doing it, if you're paying attention to those times, there are periods that are where you can get more accurate information than there are periods when you get less accurate information, or actually can get information that's totally wrong. We don't know why those things occur. We have no idea what the why standing in a specific place makes a difference. But we do know from looking at, 100,000 cases of remote viewing, that there are very specific times in a given day for the location in which you're standing where the accuracy will be better than not and at certain times. And so those kinds of things can be used to try to improve the production of the information.
Does daytime, nighttime, are those factors?
No, generally no. The particular, in the case of very specific timing, it doesn't matter whether it's light or dark, early morning, late afternoon, none of those things matter. It just has to do with where you happen to be standing at any given moment in time.
In relationships to the sun, the moon, the stars?
And again, you can't really say that because we don't know why. It certainly has to do with that in terms of, the tilt of the Earth and whether it is the remote viewer is standing in a place on the planet where the equator is currently blocking their view of the core of the galaxy. Or whether they're standing in a place on the planet where they're completely in view of the center of the galaxy, for instance. But does that mean that's the reason why, that it's affected by, for instance, the black hole in the center of the galaxy or something? We can't say that. We have no idea why. It's kind of like many people like to think that the information comes to the remote viewer, to the psychic, from an Akashic record or from some cloud of information out there that everybody gets their information from in functioning in this reality. But we don't know that to be true either. We have no idea. After probably close to 400 man years of research, we have absolutely no idea where the information comes from. Or if it comes from anywhere, it may be that we simply come into the world with all the information already in our head that we may be needing to use. But we just don't know. There's no way to pin it down.
Well, having been psychic and also being affiliated with the Monroe Institute, have you done some out-of-body astral travel, that kind of thing?
In about the 19... let me back up a second. The actual remote viewing project that the military started began in October of 1978, and I was the first individual recruited for that program, and I also happen to be the only individual that spent the entire 20 years in the 20-year program. So I'm trying to find a way of answering the question.
Without giving away too much information.
Well, no, not that. It's just that it's difficult for me to try to explain it. Is there a different way you can ask the question, maybe? What exactly are you trying to ask?
Did the Monroe Institute find you a fascinating case with given your abilities? And then were you able to expand your abilities through anything associated with out-of-body travel or astral travel? Is that a way to put it?
Now I know where you're going. I had a near-death experience in 1970, and while I was overseas. And I had a second near-death experience in 1985 after I retired a year. I was retired from the Army for a year. And in both cases, it caused me to have spontaneous out-of-bodies as a result, plus the out-of-body during the very classic near-death experience. But the Army felt that since I was already having them spontaneously, they felt that maybe... if they could hook me up with someone who professed to be able to control out-of-bodies, I could learn to control them, and I could learn to collect information aside from just in remote viewing, but I could also collect information while I'm in the out-of-body state. So I was brought to the Monroe Institute in Central Virginia and introduced to Robert Monroe. And I wound up working at the bequest of the Army. I wound up working for many months with him in his lab. And we were eventually successful in my learning how to control my out-of-bodies. As a result, I was tested by the U.S. Army and was able to demonstrate an ability to collect information in the out-of-body state as well as the remote viewing state. I also was able to, while it didn't improve my remote viewing, it was very significant in improving my prep time, what I call my cool down period, or the amount of time that I require to prepare myself between remote viewings. You know, I was doing 5 or 6 remote viewings a day, 7 days a week for many years, and was beginning to tire. And some of the agencies that were waiting on their results were becoming frustrated with my need to spend 1 or 2 hours emptying my mind from the previous mission or the previous requirement. And so the use of Bob Monroe's HemiSync and some of his procedures that he uses in his programs, it enabled me to reduce that cool-down period from approximately 1.5 hours to literally minutes, 3 to 5 minutes. So that was significant in terms of the Army's using me as a remote viewer.
Well, and beyond that, to the next question, people who've experienced out-of-body states and being able to travel and whatever, bilocate, whatever you want to call it, have also suggested that there are other encounters that make it even more fascinating and compelling because they're able to see things that exist on another level that we don't normally see with our eyes. Can you address that?
Oh, yeah. In the out-of-body state, all of your senses are functioning. They function just like they do in the awake state. So in the out-of-body state, when your senses are functioning, you're able to smell, hear, taste, touch things as well as you can in the the normal state. The difference being that those normal senses are become highly tuned. They are much more sensitive. For instance, your hearing while you're in the out-of-body state, you can actually hear things like the heartbeat in individuals. You can hear small bugs walking on carpet, those kinds of things. Hear flaws in machines while they're operating. With your vision, you can see molecular movement in both animate as well as inanimate objects. The colors are extremely intense and pure and have tremendous emotional effect on you. So, yeah, there's a lot of things that are heightened in the out-of-body state. You also are capable of touching things in the out-of-body state or pushing you're literally pushing your face into things that where you get tremendous amounts of information on something simply by melding with it or looking into it, so to speak.
When that happens, does it make you less fascinated with the material or manifest plane and more, I mean, is it seductive?
It's very seductive. It's, in fact, difficult to operate in a collection modality while you're in that state because it's highly distracting. If you have a mission of sorts that you're trying to perform, you can be distracted very easily by simple things. For instance, the beauty of a flower in the out-of-body state is enhanced a multitude of levels in comparison to seeing it in the norm. So it's easy to lose track of what it is you're there for if you're on some sort of a collection mission. So it takes a tremendous, like I said, it takes a tremendous amount of control over your mind, over your activities and things. It again, that's one of the reasons I equate it to a martial art. It takes a tremendous amount of experience and learning to maintain control of your mind and things while you're in those states.
Well, you're talking like Timothy Leary or Terrence McKenna, the kinds of experiences that would be enhanced through some form of psychotropic drug or a plant, and that I think is the difference between what you do and people experience.
One of the things that you most assuredly need to understand is that if someone truly wants to learn to do remote viewing or learn to control out of bodies, the use of psychedelics or any form of chemicals only gets in the way. It's very necessary to develop the mental discipline to control those things. And taking any kind of alcohol or drugs or anything that people claim will assist in it is not true. It just gets in the way and makes it a lot tougher and a lot more difficult.
I appreciate your information because I think that's super important because some people want to take a quick trip or a shortcut and they're so convinced. There's a lot of romance around some of these trips to South America. They come back with life-changing experiences. But to do this on a regular basis, you actually can develop the skill and that kind of muscle that gives you the ability to repeat this and have
that's
a similar
exactly
experience
right.
Rather than a totally unexpected or unexplained encounter every time you jump in.
We've had professional meditators and we've had people who have used powerful psychotropic drugs tell us at the Monroe Institute when they come for a program there that they're absolutely stunned and surprised that they're able in a single week's time using the processes within the program that teach more of a mental discipline in attaining those states, that they're stunned that they're able to do it literally within a week or a few days, something that they've spent half a lifetime trying to capture using some artificial means, like a psychotropic drug that maybe gave them a really cool experience, but it was an experience in which they were totally out of control.
Yeah.
So our programs at the Institute are literally very heavily impacting on some of the individuals that come and experience them and teaches them a tremendous amount of personal discipline.
Now, as a psychic, just dealing with that other aspect, do you have guides, guardians, others that you are able to connect with as you do some of this work?
Oh, yeah. And when I say that, everybody goes, oh, here we go. We're going into the weird stuff now. But I would contend everybody out there, every human being walking the planet has guides. And I can describe two of them immediately from the day you're born and you become consciously aware of your environment and your activities and things, there's at least two guides that you immediately come into contact with. One we envision is being in a red suit with horns and carrying a pitchfork, and he's usually whispering in the left ear and saying, go ahead, do it. Nobody will notice. You can get away with
this.
It. Yeah, and the other one's on your right shoulder and has a little white outfit and wears wings and a halo kind of cockeyed on the head. And it's saying, no, don't. It's not a good thing. Don't do it. You'll hurt other people. So in a sense, those are guides. I mean, you're dealing with your morality and your ethics all the time. And to say you don't have an inner voice that's teaching you something about that would be to, not be truthful, I think. So I consider those guides. So it's not so weird after all. Now, there are people in the world that don't have those guides. They're born with a genetic deficiency where they have absolutely no empathy towards another human being. And they probably don't have guides. But we all have some form of guides within us that tell us what's right and wrong.
Well, I think a lot of times those guides will encourage us to do the wrong thing so we can figure out how to get it right. And what happens when you do the wrong thing is you automatically experience a learning curve.
Well, not only that, but you automatically experience what's called taking responsibility and learning to assume responsibility for our actions is probably one of the most critical phases of going from childhood to adulthood. And people that do learn that are usually very successful in life, and the ones who can't learn that are very destructive.
In the decades you've been doing this, is there something that stands out as a pinnacle experience or a pinnacle piece of information that is your legacy? That what could you say from all of this? What's been the most important thing?
I'd have to say, I could start talking about a whole lot of different intelligence things that I've discovered, literally hundreds of things that no one else knew that I was able to report on, but they pale in when you start considering what it's like to find a small child that's lost and be able to bring them back to their parents healthy and whole. And that's got to be the greatest high on the planet, as far as I'm concerned.
When you connect with other cultures, at one point when I talked to you, you were dealing with, you had gone to China and were helping them with some of these types of abilities. What's the common question that other cultures have of you that they need help with? And I can imagine that the one you just mentioned. But what else have they asked you to help?
The greatest difficulty that most people have there's two things. In terms of the nature of remote viewing or psychic functioning, most ask, are there any cultures that are better than others? And I'd have to say no, that all cultures have approximately the same capabilities. Can good people or bad people, is there a difference between how well good people can do this and bad people? And no, there isn't. In fact, we do know that there are bad people, terrorists, for instance, who are using this capability. One of the difficulties is finding a defense against it. And then looking at it from the other side of the mirror, I would have to say that where it is of extremely good value, or where you get the most value from it, is in solving problems which relate to human beings. How can we, for instance, how can we figure out the problems that impact on, say, the production of rice, or is there really a climate effect, and is that climate effect actually changing the way we're going to be able to feed humanity, or is there a problem coming down the pike with water? All of these issues impact on humanity at large, regardless of culture.
So everybody does their talents at night and sleep. They go to sleep and they learn. So when you go to sleep at night, do you do remote viewing classes?
No. When I go to sleep at night, what I do is I try to pattern for a completely void night of dreams or anything else. I sleep very short periods. I only get maybe 4.5-5 hours of sleep at a time, and I would prefer to have that good solid 4 to 5 hours with no dreams or anything.
Oh, you're off the clock.
Yes, right, exactly.
Your information is fascinating, and you have a wealth of talent and a wealth of experience to draw from. So I really, really hope that anybody who is listening to this will look to your information as some kind of a template, so that they can get some accurate assessment of why not this would be a good area to explore and expand if you have any ability whatsoever. So I appreciate your time. And I appreciate all the stuff that you've done in terms of your military background as well, because we have to learn the good and the bad. And
yes,
the only way we can
absolutely
do that is by getting our own abilities enhanced and improve what we are able to do right now.
I appreciate having the opportunity of discussing this with you. And if people are more interested in it, they can, you know, seek my books out on Amazon.com. And if you have a real interest in Monroe Institute, I suggest you call them up and ask them what their programs are about and see if there's anything that might interest you.
Thank you. Thank you. We're going to close. And again, Joe McMonagle has been my guest. And if you haven't explored this, there's a difference between being psychic and remote viewing. And one is a little bit more of a disciplined approach. If you've heard any of the show, you can understand where he's coming from. But I like it because it validates these things are fully accessible to us without any form of enhancement through drugs or mind-altering substance. It's real. And we can do it. And all you have to do is give yourself the opportunity to make a mistake to learn how to do it right. Thanks for listening. This is Conscious Living on Empower Radio. I'm Wendy Garrett. Have a great day and think the best thoughts. They'll come back to you.